We are back again. Sorry, it's been a few weeks. We try to only keep these between 2 weeks at a time, but my power went out last week, and so I was stuck in the dark.
In your life or in your house?
Yeah, all over the place, in my life and in my house. But the lights are back on.
Power goes off about four times a day in my life. So, Greg, why do we keep doing this?
It's a colorful metaphor. It is.
It is.
But we're glad to be back.
Welcome back.
The box office battles with Greg and Eric. We are still doing the best, worst, bad movies ever. Like I said, we planned on this last Tuesday, but yeah, we had a like 9 below wind chill. It was unbelievable, and it went out. Power went out all over Dayton. Luckily, it came back on not too late. I didn't have to wait late. There was some people that was the next morning that they didn't get power. So I am one of the lucky ones. I had my fireplace, I had my dog, I had my book. All I needed was a pipe, like I said earlier, and I would have been just fine. But it is. We're glad to be back. It's a good time to be back. We're in our final first round battle of the best, worst, bad movies ever. Eric and I are going to break down what has come before. Eric is saying good night to his young lassie.
Kelsey came in like spooked, like, can she please come say goodnight?
No, yes. We are live. Yeah.
I already hugged her once. Isn't that enough?
A week ago.
I told her I loved her once, and if it ever changes, I'll let her know. Okay. We're almost to the end of this. Light at the end of the tunnel, Greg. It doesn't appear that it's a train.
Until we do it again, because I want to say it's been bad. The worst part has been watching of the movies. Talking about it is kind of cathartic after we watch them.
It's everything I can do for most of these to not spend the whole time just texting you like we're watching them at the same time. Because I get so, and especially as we will discuss later in one of these films,
yeah.
I got so beside myself that I just couldn't help it. We try to keep the interactions to a minimum so that the show will feel more organic or will be more organic, whether right. It feels that way or not, who fucking knows. But during one of these movies, it was just like, if I don't text somebody, I'm going to lose my mind. It's got to be someone who's also experienced this movie as well. But we'll get into that later. Yeah,
yeah.
It's the last one, right?
The last first round battle. The time we were here, we had Tiptoes took the crown of the last round battle that we had. And this is where our bracket is right now. Tiptoes beat Manos, Hands of Fate. And I think there was no debate on that. Manos is a crappy film, but Tiptoes is a crappy film that tries to be a good film. And that's even more insulting. So this is our three of our final four. We've got Mac and me that beat Plan 9 from Outer Space. And we've also got Battlefield Earth, our first round, first battle winner over Catwoman. I think these three so far have earned their spots in the final four for sure.
I can appreciate that you and I both will give a little bit of grace and a little bit of leeway to Manos, Hands of Fate, and Plan 9 from Outer Space, which are also, you know, bad movies.
Yeah.
But they retain and maintain a little bit of charm that I wouldn't ask any of our listeners to watch any of these movies. But if you did, I would dare you to find any charm in the three that we moved to the next round. You're not going to find it in Battlefield Earth or Tiptoes or Mac and Me. It's void of all charm or anything of the sort.
If you want an excruciating movie experience, these three are it. Plan 9 and Manos, as bad as they are, there are some of these movies that when they have these cult classics that they put up in midnight showings that people can go to and just laugh their balls off. It's like, oh, this is so crappy, but it's so deliciously wonderful in its crappiness. Those are okay. Even Catwoman, to some extent, as bad as it is, doesn't even compare to the feelings I felt. Like, I love movies. We've talked about this before. Grew up in the movie theater. And watching Battlefield Earth, Mac and Me, and Tiptoes, it is a struggle. Every minute of screen time, and I love film, and they make me want to hate film. That's how bad these things are. They make me want to hate movies. I think
that's got to be an extra level of excruciating for you, because for me, I just feel like it's not time wasted, because like you said, watching the movie is one thing, but then you and I get to talk about it, and I enjoy having this outlet for tangents that I want to go on. But for you, for someone who's, this stuff's important to you. You know, you didn't have any reason beyond, you know, your own interest in film to go back to school and to learn more about it and to study it. And, you know, so it's obvious that that plays a big role in your life. You told us in one of the earlier episodes about spending your days at the theater. And so for it to mean that much to you, and for someone to just, you know, serve you a pile of doo-doo like some of these is just,
yeah,
it's wild, man.
It's everything when you study cinema, that's everything that's wrong about cinema. And so, yeah, it is kind of offensive to the eyes. The other thing is that my goal when I went back to get my master's and I chose film was one of those things that it was something that I loved and I wanted to do more. And the goal was either to be a screenwriter or a film historian. And a lot of film historians, you can do that with a master's, but mainly you want that PhD. And when I saw the work that was required for the PhD, I went, well, maybe I'll start a podcast instead.
I'll go to the School of Hard Knocks and start a podcast.
So,
but see, here's the deal about our podcast, yes, is we talk about movies, but we also make jokes, Greg. And I think that really sets us apart from a lot of. No, it probably doesn't. But it doesn't matter to me at all.
No, it's the therapy that counts as far as the jokes. That's the only way we can not cry when we watch some of these films, because these ones were bad. And tonight, the final first round battle is between two pretty bad films. One probably more bad than the other.
I don't know, man.
We'll be debatable on it.
We're gonna get into this.
But it's The Room, who is our number one overall seed. One of the reasons we started doing this category. I mean, it is considered a cult classic of badness, versus the number eight seed, our last entry in, and Kevin Costner's very expensive water epic ode to Mad Max, that is Waterworld. And we're gonna kick it off with Waterworld. Now, actually, we got a couple of our regulars in. Want to say hi to real quick. We don't do the Patreon thing, so we don't say hi to everybody. But Charles Glanville IV this year, so saying hi. We're glad, Chuck, that you could be with everybody else that's in the live stream. Glad that we could see Chuck in there, as well as Mike Florida. Mike Florida said The Room was tough to find. He had to watch it on the Internet Archive. Wish I had not found it. We will get into The Room after Waterworld. But yeah, The Room is not an easy one to find. I think they play it on Cartoon Network on April Fool's Day every year, and you could watch it there like at midnight, something like that, I heard. But there's not a lot of places you can screen it, which is really weird because it's a horrible film, but it's like Tommy Wiseau has got this thing down on lock.
He does, yeah. I went to their website even, and I would have... Hey, you know, I pay to watch some of these movies on Amazon or whatever. I would have paid if, you know, you have to just do that on the site. There was no way. His website is as amateurish as this movie was. It's wild. I will talk to you about something I found on The Room website, though, later when we talk about it. Waterworld, Greg, we finally, of the eight movies.
Yes.
We have found one that does not belong within 1,000 miles of this category.
Yeah.
There is very little wrong with Waterworld, except that it underperformed based on budget or expectation. But other than that, this movie's fine. Sure. Maybe they could have developed the characters in a way that made us care about them more.
Yeah.
They didn't. None of them. You know, some of the acting was really over the top, while some of the acting was really under the top, and it just never seemed to sync up.
Yeah.
But it wasn't meant to be Well, I was going to say Citizen Kane, but that movie sucks too. It wasn't meant to be The Godfather. You know, it was, like you said, it was Mad Max on ice. No, on water.
Mad Max on ice would be incredible. We need to work on that.
I take the kids to Disney on ice, but if I showed up and it was Mad Max on ice.
Oh, could you imagine? Oh, that's a missed opportunity. I need to get on that. We need to produce that show.
For adults? Oh. Like you serve beer and it's,
oh, man. That would be great. Dude, just think of it.
Write that down.
Dudes on like snowmobiles with mohawks. Oh, yeah. That would be great.
But people just, look, this was a big budget movie.
Yes.
It fell flat compared to its budget, compared to its big name star. I mean, you probably, at the time, Costner was a top five guy. And so the combination of things that it should have had going for it just set expectations that I don't know that, you know, I mean, listen, Greg, and I don't, we're here to compare these two movies,
right?
But you really want to tell me that like Avatar, the movie that made $2 billion, is significantly better than Waterworld? Like, it's better, but it's not that much better.
So here's my thing on Avatar, since we go down that road. And first of all, Waterworld, yeah, it's crazy if you look at it. Metascore 56 and IMDb 6.3. But here's the deal. I think that's all happened since it came out. Because I remember when Waterworld came out, and it was 1995, and it was considered a joke. It was as far as, like, I can't believe this movie exists. And so nobody really wanted to see it when it came out because of that, because of it was too derivative of Mad Max and just being on water. And they've got all the elements there. They've got the guy in the sky. They got the little kid roaming around, you know, and they've got him as the silent brooding type that's going to, instead of get oil, he's going to take them to the promised land, to Earth, to real land. It was everything that it was. And I think that people saw that. And so nobody went to see it at the movie theater. But I think a lot of people, it's one of those on video that just caught on. And I remember seeing it like a year after it came out, and it wasn't great, but I laughed through the whole thing. Not because it was bad, but laughed because it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Visually, like, the action sequences are fun to watch. The dude's going around on the jet skis, hiding underneath the water with the it was good. Yeah.
There was plenty about it. I mean, the raid on the initial little
compound
they had was like well choreographed. It was neat to watch. And yeah, I mean, like you said, and I think it's a really good point about, you know, the action without the characters, kind of what we fell into with Catwoman, where it's a lot of glitter and there's nothing, you know, once that glitter settles, there's nothing there. And that's kind of how it feels with Waterworld, because Kevin Costner, I guess he's our protagonist in this, although he kind of just toes the line between not giving a shit and self survival instinct, I guess.
He's Max.
Yeah,
you watch the Road Warrior.
Have an allegiance to much.
No, it's like the Road Warrior. That's exactly Mel Gibson in the Road Warrior. He's just like, I just want my gas. Get me out of here. I just want my gas. You know, and it's the same type of thing. Like we were talking about Avatar. So my thing is, and this may be an unpopular opinion. I can't stand Avatar. It is one of my least liked films. And the reason I don't like it is, to me, it's derivative of Dances with Wolves and many other films like that. It's and I don't get into these cliches. I'm not a big cliche guy, but I'm going to put this out there. It's the white savior guy who comes into the tribe of settlers and helps them defeat the military industrial complex that's threatening to wipe out. It's been done a million times.
Yeah, we always forget about all the good things white people did for natives.
So, again, I don't want to get down the political road, but it's the same trope. It is the same trope. And Dances with Wolves does it so much better. You get the sense of isolation that Kevin Costner's character and then immersing himself with the tribe. The characters are more likable. This was just a bunch of pretty CGI. And so I prefer Waterworld to Avatar, if I'm going to be 100% honest. That may be not everybody's opinion. It's mine. And it's ridiculous, but yeah, it's derivative. But I think the more you remove it from Road Warrior, the more that it stands on its own, even though it's, again, it's not meant to be the Godfather. It's meant to be an action epic, and it's fun to watch. So
yeah, and they didn't they do this with the character on purpose because they don't even give him a name. His name is just like
Mariner.
Mariner.
Yeah, the Mariner.
Seafaring guy, which they all are. And so except for those who haven't seen it, it's kind of this gritty survival of the fittest. Everyone's, you know, all man for himself. You may team up with some people to kind of, you know, mutually establish some interests, but always be careful because you never know. And okay, that's fine enough.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of flimsy to base a plot around. Of course the plot is going to revolve around, I mean, it's kind of like Moana, you know, like somebody knows where the secret is. It happens to be this little kid.
There is a part where he like tips the pontoon boat sideways. If he were to sing the Moana song at the same time.
Yeah. From the stars and the moon and the something.
And find me. that would have been perfect. There's that scene where he tips the thing and everything. So they just needed The Rock in this to make it a perfect film.
Now, he's not the only cast member we know from this. I know Jeannie Triplehorn.
Yep.
As the other lady in Basic Instinct. And then Tina Majorino is in this. And when I said to Kelsey, who was sitting next to me, that's Tina Majorino, I said, she's from
Napoleon Dynamite.
She's whatever her name is in Napoleon Dynamite.
Is it Deb or something like that? She's the one that has the hair, the ponytail, side ponytail.
The side pony. But Kelsey said, that's what you know her from? Because I know her from, was it like some sort of like Babysitter's Club or
something like that, yeah. You ever watch in Mike
Florida? Karina.
Karina. Karina
is what she knew her from.
Yep. Mike Florida just asked if we're going to do a take one return from Jared Goes to the Movies. That we're sitting here singing
the Moana song, something completely unrelated. Okay, that would be a good bit, though. Every now and then, I just do a take one. And it's just a song we talked about during the episode that had nothing to do with anything.
But going back to the movie, she's one of those child actresses I immediately had to look up because I've watched the movie a few hundred times. I actually own it. And I watched it. I have it on 4K, but it's a beautiful film.
You've watched this 100 times?
I've watched it a lot. Yeah. I like this movie a lot. I like this movie a lot. I don't consider it a great film. I don't even consider it a good one. I just consider it enjoyable as an action film. It makes me laugh. I like the characters. I like the stuff that happens. And it's beautiful in 4K. The thing is I didn't own it before the 4K came out, and it was considered such a bad, I don't even know how it got a 4K release, but it was only like $7.99. And I saw and I was like at Best Buy. I went, well, for $8 for a 4K film, you on principle, you got to get it. I would buy a lump of shit for $8 if it was in 4K.
Well, remind me to get your address.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll send you some shit in 4K.
So I just like the film. And I've even watched the 3-hour version, which is maybe a bit much, but it is enjoyable. There's a 3-hour version.
If it's just more of the same type of stuff, then that's fine.
Yeah.
Because again, it's just a bunch of haters who, for whatever reason, felt the need to tear down Kevin Costner at his highest
that's pretty much it.
You know, you're not allowed to spend $200 million on a movie unless it's, you know, the next great American cinematic masterpiece. I don't know what it is. It's the studio's money. It's not your money. You shouldn't concern yourself with how much it costs as you're sitting there and watching it. You either enjoyed it or you didn't. And I think people who say, I didn't enjoy this movie, have either A, unrealistic expectations of what they're supposed to be watching, or B, have let some things that people have said about this movie poison the well. And so you go in going, I'm about to watch this giant piece of shit movie, and it's nothing like that. No. Now, I have a serious question for you.
Okay.
As serious as questions get between you and I on this show.
Right.
I don't know enough about the guy, and I don't know enough about his body of work to know the answer to this. Is Dennis Hopper considered to be a good actor? Like, I think of these old man actors.
I would say so. I mean, if you know, he's
not in this.
No, but he goes way back in the early days of Hollywood where he would play a lot of straight roles. He's in a really good John Wayne film called The Sons of Katie Elder, where he plays the main bad guy's son, and he's so neurotic and he's so good in it. And he evolved into taking these character roles. But then in the 60s, when he became like the king hippie of all king hippie actors, he played a role in Apocalypse Now as Marlon Brando's kind of herald. You know, the guy that is, he was a journalist that got into Marlon Brando's cult in Vietnam. And he is, it's just a great performance. Wow, man, you're not going to believe it, dude. He just freaks out and yells a lot. And it just is a really cool character. And then he's done a lot of really good films over the years. And I actually am a big fan of Dennis Hopper. God rest his soul. He was a unique individual. He was that caricature. And then later in life, he became like in Speed. Remember, he was the bad guy in Speed with Keanu Reeves. If you've never seen that,
I have.
You know, what would you do, man? You know, he was that intense character actor. I really loved Hopper. And yeah, and Kriplius brings up Easy Rider again. Another great film if you've never seen it. It started that counterculture movement in cinema, and with him and Peter Fonda. It's a great film to explore that era. It's like a time capsule into the 60s. So Easy Rider is another example. So yes, I would consider him a great actor. When they got him at this point of his career, he was kind of, you know, doing whatever he could. He did Speed. He was doing the bad guy roles. So I don't fault him for doing this. I think he's great as the bad guy. I love the little subtle things that they put in here, you know, that their crew worships St. Joe. Did you pick up on that?
Yeah.
And so through the whole film that they worship St. Joe, and you're like, what is this St. Joe? What is this thing that is St. Joe? And then they don't reveal it until like near the end of the film when they show the ship and they have the thing on the side, and he looks at Captain Joe Hazelwood. For those of you who don't know, Captain Joe Hazelwood was the captain of the Exxon Valdez.
The drunk captain,
that ran it aground and caused the oil spill. And so it turns out that the tanker that Dennis Hopper is inhabiting, it's just a cute little like inside joke kind of thing that it's actually the Exxon Valdez, and they've got all this oil on it. It just adds to the lore of the film, but it's kind of one of those jokes that he carries through, which is really funny.
I mean, I guess if you're an actor in 1995 or 1994, I guess, and you get a call from your agent and say, hey, are you interested in doing this film Waterworld with Kevin Costner? Be like, the budget's how much? Yeah, I'll do that. You know, I don't know what they're paying these guys. I don't know if it's, you know, the same across movies or union scale or what, but yeah, you get a chance to be in a movie. Although, like, you only have to get four names deep into this before you don't recognize any of the actors, you know?
Yeah, that's true. There is one. Did you pick up on the one actor?
Man, all right. Hold on. I'm looking at the...
Do you want me to bring the still up? I have the still. There's one actor
in here. Okay, bring the still up.
Yeah, there's one actor in here that does
a small bit.
Yeah.
Because the audience has to know Jack Black.
That is Jack Black, yes. He plays the pilot, the crazy pilot that is shooting from the sky, and then he gets hit with the spear in the side, the plane does, and it ends up circling around and around the mast. And then
I saw his name pop up, and I think I remember saying, I don't remember seeing Jack Black in this thing.
It's very quick.
It's not the Jack Black we know.
No. 95
in career. Yeah.
Yeah, just a baby.
I mean, yeah, I wonder what he was doing. Like, when did he break out?
I think
I'm going to start doing this more. I watched a podcast the other day while I was out in the garage having drinks with Kelsey, and I realized, like, you can just look things up and talk about it. It's not ruining the flow of the show.
No,
in fact, you know who it was? It was this, I don't know if you've heard of these guys.
Yeah.
I typed in Jack White. It's not Jack White. He's from the White Stripes.
The White Stripes, yes. Kriplius thinks 1999 with Orange County with Colin Hanks. That's actually a good guess. He was doing the Tenacious D stuff around there too. A little bit over 2000 is when the tribute song came out, and he did, you know, kind of explode it. And then it was High Fidelity was a really good film with John Cusack, where he worked in a record store. I think that one was kind of a breakout role for Jack Black as well. I remembered him from that. Like, that was the first thing I was like wanting to see more of this guy. But
yeah. I mean, I got to scroll way down here to 95. Yeah, he was doing a bunch of nothing, a bunch of nothing.
Yep, did Waterworld.
He's in an episode of The X-Files and Touched by an Angel.
Where?
Yeah, exactly. He's in The Cable Guy, apparently. Oh, I know. Mars Attacks is the first thing I remember him in, because he's got that buzz cut, you know, like army guy.
Yep.
Although I think he gets like blown up pretty quick.
Yeah. So it's like similar to this movie. Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. But yeah, so that was, you're right. Gene Triplehorn in this, and Kevin Costner, Dennis Hopper, Jack Black in a tiny role. Nobody knew who he was. And then they kind of, the budget else went to, I think it went to a lot of jet skis, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's where the budget went. Listen, because there's a lot
of... These people can't find shit. They can't find anything of value because everything's covered in water.
Everything's under the water.
Under the sea.
Then again, it could have been a great musical. We need to come up with Waterworld on Ice, the musical.
They played a song in this thing that I went... Wait a second. This is like out of place. I need to. Peter Gunn. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So listen, all of the music in this thing is just like thematic orchestral pieces. Yeah. You know, nothing you'd recognize.
Alan Silvestri, I believe.
The same guy that did
Mac and Tiptoes?
Mac and Me.
I think it was Mac and Me. You keep talking. I'm going to look it up.
And it was. And then all of a sudden, they're putting a plan together. It's kind of like a montage, but not exactly a montage. And they start with this Peter Gunn theme, so weirdly, oddly out of place.
Right.
Because it's kind of like you're crafting an environment, obviously, where the entire Earth is covered in water, except for, as we find out later, one piece of land. Which I will take a small digression here, because if the entire Earth is covered in water,
yes,
and you found land, then the land you found is the top of Mount Everest, right?
Probably.
I mean, it's got to be like,
looked a lot like Hawaii to me.
Okay, but that's the whole thing. It's like, I don't care how long the Earth's been underwater.
Yeah.
I don't think Everest goes from glacial ice caps
to Hawaii.
To that.
Yeah, it was pretty lush and green. This kind of movie, you pretty much just have to take the old thinking cap off, because it's an excellent point. The water is not going to, it's going to distribute evenly.
It's
going to distribute evenly. That's how water works.
Okay, but it find doesn't
a tropical distribute mountain
evenly, because here I'm watching this video the other day.
Yeah.
You ever heard of this thing, the Panama Canal?
Okay, yeah. Heard of this thing.
And I know that you go through here and like part of it is a giant lake, but then you get into this series of locks that have to take you up from one side or down from another, because apparently like the Atlantic is 200 feet higher than the Pacific. But how come that water doesn't just come flooding? Why do you need all this?
Oh,
if water distributes evenly, and you know why?
Yeah,
they say that the Earth might be flat.
Yeah.
And I think maybe there's something to this. Greg.
No, we're not gonna go down the earth as flat I don't podcast. Know.
But anyway,
although we could explore that in another episode.
Theoretically, it like you said, it all distributes evenly. The only thing that can be at the top is the top of Mount Everest. Well, they did find it,
but
that's
good. With the new environmental conditions that we have, maybe that is Everest. Maybe it is a lush, green, tropical environment because the earth is flooded due to climate change. And
it's been long enough to where Kevin Costner's character, the Mariner, has developed
gills. Yes.
He has and gills. People react to it pretty negatively.
He's able to go underwater for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, you know, think about fish, Greg. Think about how long they spend underwater.
Yeah. He doesn't come
almost up. Their whole lives.
Yeah. And he goes exploring in all the old cities. I did love this scene, but it made me wonder, like, he takes Gene Triplehorn's character down here, Helen, down onto to the downtown, but she's under the, how much oxygen is in this little dome? Because there's no line running to it. He just puts it over her, and that's all the oxygen she has, yet he takes her down again.
The amount of oxygen available in any given circumstance in any given movie is directly related to how much of an agenda you have to create, like, suspense and a feeling of, like, this needs to be done now.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
because the oxygen's running out.
Yeah.
But there's no, they need to get like one Hollywood science person who can just go to the movies and keep this stuff consistent. Cause here she is. Okay. Also, he took her down to Denver, I believe. Right.
Yeah. Wherever
this it is was, the same city in Battlefield Earth that they show, by the way.
Oh, that's an interesting connection.
Are we living in the same
universe? It's possible. Okay. But so
secondly, how long do you think it takes to sail unpowered from Denver, where he shows her that, to fucking Mount Everest?
I don't know. I you know, even if it were Hawaii, which is what it looked like, one of the mountains in Hawaii, which I think it was where it was filmed, but it would take an extremely long time. But what I want to know is that when they reveal the city underneath, and he takes her all the way down there, that's like a Planet of the Apes Statue of Liberty moment. Like, holy crap. And I don't know how a little brown trouser shark didn't drop out of her pants when she sees that. I want to see something just float underneath the capsule, like, or something, because it would freak. It should freak her out. And like Cripley said, how does she not panic? You're down that much. And pressure. There's pressure. You know, I used to scuba dive. You can't go down that far and come right
back. Didn't we
up.
Learn this from a recent submarine incident?
Yeah.
That pulverized.
Exactly. Why didn't she just implode? I mean, it's like we said, it's one of those movies that, yes, is it a cinematic masterpiece? No, it is what it is. You got to take your thinking cap off in certain films. So if somebody said, I hate this film, it really sucks for all of these reasons we're laying out, I would go, yeah, I get you. I totally get it. But if I'm just putting on something fun, it is a stereotypical 90s action movie with that type of cinematography. By the way, music wasn't Alan Silvestri. It was John David Howard or somebody like that, which I had not heard of. But it's got that same type of orchestral music, except for the Peter Gunn theme that's in there. But
if someone said that to me about this movie, then I would just immediately know I could disregard every opinion they ever had about anything.
Yeah.
Because you didn't show up to this movie for its historical or scientific accuracy,
you
shithead. So don't hold it to some standard you made up just for the sole purpose of not enjoying it. Because it's just like saying, you know, I guess I would have liked Waterworld, but I just don't feel like they paid enough homage to the Revolutionary War. Well, no one said it was about the fucking Revolutionary War. You just made that up. You don't get to hold it. You don't get to hold it to that standard just because you need some reason to shit on this.
Yeah. So you should know going in what you're going to get. Exactly. Now, you just brought up an interesting thing. So we were talking about Denver and Battlefield Earth. are these in the same universe? When did this occur? Because we know the world comes to an end in Battlefield Earth. Maybe it was underwater first because there's somebody else that pops up. And I just happen to have the picture from Battlefield Earth of the caveman dude. They does that. And he's the barter guy in this one. And then I thought, wait a minute, is this in the same universe as Battlefield Earth? Could be. Could be.
Man, we need to fully explore this. Maybe we'll spend 8 episodes getting into... God, can you imagine what a pain in the ass and just, like, what a waste of life it would be to sit down and try to, like, academically get into Battlefield Earth and Waterworld and how they're... Yeah. Like, that doesn't seem... That doesn't seem right. Yeah, this guy, like most in Waterworld, and I don't mean the movie, I just mean the planet where water is the world, meets a demise that, I mean, I guess that much isolation and just floating around in water. Okay, but my thing is, and again, I know scientific accuracy aside, don't you feel like you would just be sunburned to death within about 2 days? Like, because I go to the pool with my kids, and I live in Texas. It can be 108 out there. It's hot.
Yeah.
And you have to reapply sunscreen every 15, 20 minutes if you don't want to get burned.
Yeah.
And or, I just feel
over
like...
time, their pigment would change, and it would have been a whole different movie. That's all I'm saying is that generations would come, there would adapt, you know, to the environment, and so you wouldn't burn. And so that's kind of weird. Yeah, I feel bad for this character because he makes a fair trade, and that friggin' mariner goes back on it right when he's just about to get his part of the deal.
Yeah, explain the trade to us, Greg, because we really want to hear about this fair trade that you have in mind.
It was agreed upon. It was shaken upon. I don't really, you know, I'm not going to judge the trade, but we know that the
elements involved in the trade?
There was paper, which is very rare in Waterworld. Mm-hmm. Nobody has paper. It's extremely valuable. It's like $1 million. And he gets, 30 minutes to do whatever he wants to Gene Triplehorn, Helen.
Mm-hmm. Because the mariner's treating her like property.
Exactly. So,
and as we know throughout history, well, I guess historically, inaccuracies aside,
he's paying $1 million for the right. That's a $1 million prostitute. That's pretty expensive.
This is indecent proposal type stuff.
Pretty much. It's expensive.
It happens in the same universe as Indecent Proposal.
It could be that. He could be the offspring of Woody Harrelson.
I don't know. I mean, we can treat the movie like this because this is how the movie should be treated.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I mean, maybe their intent was to do something better than this. And it could have been, you know, make no mistake about it, it could have been done better.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is the one movie of the 8 that we have watched that really sticks out like a sore thumb as not needing to be a part of this exploration of worst movies. This movie is like The Godfather compared to the other ones that we've watched.
Without a
this
doubt.
Is great. So I really enjoyed Waterworld.
When we talk about it, you know, when I think about watching it again recently, it's like, unlike the others, I don't have to check my phone. I can just sit there and have it on and be chill and have some popcorn and have a laugh. And I don't feel like I'm going through excruciating pain. So I agree. Yeah. It is considered a flop. It is considered a bust. It is considered a bad film. But these days, I don't think it's considered as bad as it was. Before we get into the room and leave, I do want to talk about my favorite character, the dude in the hull of the ship of the Exxon Valdez, because who can't relate to the dude who works down there night and day, just doing the oil thing, never gets let out. And when that match drops down into that, he looks.
Doesn't he say finally?
He says, like, thank God or something. Oh, thank God. And the whole thing blows up. Who can't relate to that kind
of
dude?
Release of death.
Probably my favorite moment. Probably my favorite character of the film. I absolutely love that scene, because who can't? If you're a working man, can you not relate to the dude just saying, "Oh, thank God it's over now"?
He's just down there upset that the shareholders are going to have to take a loss on this one. You know, it's a real bummer.
That's basically what happened with that match. Although the whole match scene when they're like, he's dangling it over, like we couldn't see that foreshadowing a mile away.
Yeah.
But still, but that's
the
movie's
movie
funny.
Is not subtle.
No. I mean,
and even, you know, I think it's trying to make a couple, like you said earlier, it's trying to make some points about some things. And, you know, it's ham-fisted attempt at it. And I don't care.
Yeah, no.
Because I had a good time.
Yeah, and in the end, he gets them, the Mariner gets the survivors to the island, mountain, whatever. And then he can't stay because his place is in the sea.
He yeets on out of there. He's a man of the water.
He sails off into the sunset like a true hero. He can't be with the woman he loves because... he's too big
Which
for
basically
that.
Means we are watching the end of civilization the most part.
It's kind of like the Little Mermaid too. So yeah. That's why Under the Sea is appropriate. It's a little bit of Moana. It's a little bit Little Mermaid. It's a little bit Road Warrior. So it's an amalgam of some incredible films, and that makes it enjoyable to film. I will say one thing about Kevin Costner though, going out, is that it was weird. Because he had Robin Hood, which was a huge movie, and then, you know, he had Dances with Wolves, it was a great big movie. He had some really great films, and then he had this series where the critics were like, we're not going to give you a decent review no matter what you do, because he did The Postman, this.
I wondered if that was around that same time.
Around the same time, yeah. And then Wyatt Earp, which, because they had Tombstone came out the same time as that, and overshadowed Wyatt Earp, which was his three-hour epic that was the same as Tombstone. So, yeah, it is, I don't know. It's interesting.
Kripke says all Bodyguard.
Costner director movies are a little crack you over the head with the theme. And that is true. It Costner, I find, to me, is not one of my favorite actors in Hollywood. Only because I told my wife, we were watching the film, and I don't mind him. He's a decent-looking guy, and he's a decent-looking action hero. But even in Dances with Wolves, isn't he just a little bit monotone? He's
pretty
monotone type actor.
But he's playing in that one, he's playing a grizzled vet of the, Indian westward expansion wars or whatever, you have any idea how exhausting that would be, Greg, to murder that many?
But it just, I'm just saying, I don't want to diss on the guy. I don't watch Yellowstone. I want to give it a try, but I've never watched it. I understand he's good in it, but. He just comes off a little monotone to me. I do like him as an actor, but I wouldn't put him up there in the favorites. You know
but
what?
Dude, talk about a turning point in this dude's career, because I'm going to read off from The Untouchables to Bull Durham to Field of Dreams to Dances with Wolves to Robin Hood to JFK to The Bodyguard to Wyatt Earp to Waterworld.
Yeah.
Now that's our line of demarcation, because then we get Tin Cup, The Postman, Message in a Bottle, For the Love of the Game, 3,000 Miles to Graceland.
Even 13 Days wasn't that good.
Rumor has it. I mean, Field of Dreams 2, The Lock.
Yeah.
This, what a shitty.
Electric Boogaloo.
Boy, they really.
Yeah.
This kind of. Messed him up there for a while.
Yeah. Until he became Jonathan Kent in Man of Steel, and then he made his comeback. But, you know, every actor has, you know, when they age, they either have to go into TV and redefine themselves or just take those older roles in which he's had to do. He's had some decent movies since then. Honestly, Kevin Costner is one of the, iconic actors of my generation. So... I know when I met my wife, she was a huge Robin Hood Prince of Thieves fan because it was the only movie they owned on VHS in their little apartment where she lived. And so they had no cable, and the regular TV didn't come in, so they watched. That's what they watched all the time. So she ingrained that movie into her. So when I met her, she was watching that. So all the time. So I have a fond memory of that. I like Kevin Costner, but there's other great 90s actors. I think he had a weird thing. But you know who is my favorite actor tonight that we're going to talk about?
Is it Tommy?
Yeah.
Tommy, however you pronounce his last name.
Wiseau, man. Tommy Wiseau.
Jesus fucking
so let's, yeah,
Christ.
Let's get into this. I mean, we're not the first people to talk about this film. It's the first time we've talked about it on this podcast. We haven't really done bad movies, but other people have tackled this. And I feel sorry for them as much as I feel sorry for ourselves.
This is the most unhinged thing I have ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I have not had a visceral reaction to anything that we've seen like what I had while I was watching this. My watch alerted me that my heart rate was up, elevated. I was texting you.
Yeah, you did.
I thought to myself, if you'll just keep watching, some of this will start to make sense. And I would argue that it started to make less sense the more I watched it. Dude, this is the craziest thing I have ever seen in my whole life. And I don't mean to play spoiler for this episode. I get the sense that we're going to be on the same page on this.
Yeah.
I would not recommend someone go back and watch Battlefield Earth or Mac and Me or Tiptoes. I think you could just live your life perfectly fine because it's not going to move the needle. I would encourage people, if you're brave enough, to watch The Room if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Like Kevin Costner's career pre and post Waterworld, your life will be different pre and post watching The Room.
Yeah.
And you'll think back to a time where this movie didn't exist as something that you know and are familiar. Okay.
It just
Greg pulls up a picture of Tommy Wiseau holding a football.
He loves football.
Which is ironic because in the movie, there is not a person who touches this football who doesn't look like it's the first time they've ever seen this object.
Yeah.
And someone handed it to them and said, you have to guess what this is for. It's either food or it's, you know, a safety flotation device or it's a ball. You guys figure it out. Figure it out, they do. But this is crazy.
Yeah.
He looks like my six-year-old daughter throwing the football around.
Oh, yeah.
There's one, the one guy, Mark, can throw the football.
Yeah.
Okay. The rest of them look like they're in danger the whole time they're throwing it around. And Greg, I have thrown a football with plenty of people in my life.
Yeah.
Never have I run parallel to that person and underhand tossed it back and forth as we ran along like these buffoons did. It was crazy. But I will say this. I went to The Room website. I was having some difficulty locating where I can stream this movie.
Right.
And I went to The Room website. As I stated earlier, the website's a real piece of garbage, just like this movie is. But they sell in the store on the website autographed footballs from Tommy Wiseau that you can buy. And that's brilliant that they have leaned into the fact that it looks like their first day on Earth. And
it's a dominant part of the film because I guess Tommy associated football with being all American and, you know, he's trying to fit in with, like, that's what guys do is they just go out and play football, and he wants to be one of the guys. It's a very strange aspect of the film. But if for those who haven't seen it, it's a hard film to describe. I like Eric said, I wouldn't not recommend it just once But trust me, it's not easy to watch. I know people watch it in these big, you know, screenings, and they have a few drinks beforehand, and it becomes this cult kind of practice. Maybe I would enjoy it that way, but watching it in my living room by myself, because this is the first time I'd seen the movie The Disaster Artist that talks about the making of with the Franco brothers and Seth Rogen and others. And so I knew about the background, but I don't think I'd ever really sat down and watched it outside of the clips that I've always seen on YouTube and whatever.
Yeah.
So I decided,
it's tearing me apart, Lisa, yeah, and the Highmark.
Yeah, exactly. So I, you know, I knew those and I knew the basic. I didn't realize, and I'm going to show this clip from, or this comment from Mike Florida, who says, I think my wife and I are just going to have to watch it together every time we want to warm up for a romantic evening. Good Lord, are there enough sex scenes?
Dude, it got to the point where a new character would walk into the room and I would be like, please don't let this lead to another sex scene.
It's like, it was the weirdest thing, because they have the initial sex scene with Lisa and Johnny, Tommy Wiseau, and it's so awkward. It is so non-erotic. There's nothing that will entice you in this film that's titillating or anything. And then they have the creepy interaction with the adopted son, the pillow fight in the bed. But then you think, okay, they've got the sex scene out of the way.
We know there's in love now.
There's no need. If you watch any action movie or drama, there's usually one scene like that with the sheets flowing and the wind blowing through the breeze and the sexy music. There's usually one, maybe two in a film.
If you've got to shoehorn one in here, then yeah, it needs to be with Mark, right? Because yeah, you've already established you're yeah, in a relationship with this guy. He brought you a dress.
Yeah.
We've already established that you're in a relationship yeah, with him. He's a big time yeah, banking associate who's making the bank a bunch of money. So you don't have to have sex with him. We already know y'all are getting married in a month.
Yes.
So the odds are, you know, this isn't the 1950s. Y'all have been doing it.
Yeah.
So if you've got to put one in here, you got to show the one with Mark.
Yeah.
But exactly. Jesus. And yes, they clearly reused footage from the first scene.
They show them having sex, Lisa and Johnny, at least three times. Then they have the other couple, and then they have the Mark and Lisa.
Makes it worse?
Yeah,
is that they overdub sexual sounds on top of it, and like that's crazy, dude. Because it was already out of place and like so amateurishly yeah, done.
Yeah,
but then to take that scene and then put somebody in a voiceover booth and go, okay, just kind of at your discretion,
yeah,
moan and grunt and make weird thrusting noises. Dude, it makes it crazy and worse.
Yeah.
I mean,
this
thing is exhausting.
It's an experience for sure. And it was one of those things like where it just like, here's the image of the pillow fight with the how awkward these things were. The whole movie, that's the best way you can sum up the movie, is it the whole thing is awkward.
Dude, everything is unnatural.
Yes. Nothing fits. The dialogue is so amateurish, and it's clearly written by somebody where English is their second language or their third language, and he's trying his hardest to fit in with the dialogue, but it's so basic, and his delivery, and really, I'd be honest with you, if Tommy Wiseau wasn't in it, and it was just a regular guy playing Johnny, it would be a horrible film that no one would ever have watched or anybody ever would care about. What Tommy Wiseau brings is this over-the-top awkwardness that yeah, that he misdelivers his lines. He overreacts when he laughs. He reacts wrong to certain things. If you watch the movie The Disaster Artist, it's great where there's the scene on the roof where Mark tells the horrible story about the woman who gets beat up. And he goes, ha, that's funny, Mark. And he's like, yes. And Seth Rogen's like, but that's not funny. It is a, it's a tragic story. So as we're talking about that, I have that clip. It is the iconic rooftop scene from, and we got a few, a couple of clips from the room that we're going to show tonight. Didn't have any for Waterworld. There was no need. Waterworld didn't, we didn't need to go into it, but you got to see this. If you've never seen the movie before, and even if you have, just enjoy this iconic clip from The Room.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny. What's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask. What's new with you?
Well, I'm just sitting up here thinking, you know? I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You think girls like to cheat like guys do?
What makes you say that?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm just thinking.
I don't have to worry about that because Lisa's loyal to me.
Yeah, man, you never know.
Yeah.
People are very strange these days. I used to know a girl. She had a dozen guys. One of them found out about it, beat her up so bad she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street.
What a story, Mark.
Yeah, you can say that again.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Sometimes we come back from break and you can't hear me.
Oh, well, I can hear you. There you go. Yeah, it is. That's the perfect example of that, where it's everything. The conversations are awkward. The dialogue is awkward. And the storyline itself is pretty basic. And they just drag it out for 2 hours of this infidelity storyline. There's these subplots that never go anywhere, which I find interesting.
Lisa's mom having breast cancer,
yes,
but then...
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're curing something. Well, the test didn't say she had breast cancer. She's like, well, I'm pretty sure I do.
Yeah, I'm 99% sure, or something like that. Yeah, it's...
The thing is, there's no consistency to the way the characters act. I mean, first of all, it's like you said, the dialogue's so bad, and you and I have talked before on previous episodes about how writing dialogue's really difficult because... Yeah. We speak in ways that we don't write, and we write in ways we don't speak. And so I think that's a real talent for people. You know, I think the Gilmore Girls is a good example of, like, I mean, people like that show, but people don't talk that way in real life. Right. It's just rapid fire, you know, the most obscure references, like Dennis Miller type weird stuff. People don't talk that way. Yeah. And so it's hard to get that right. But there's also inconsistency. Like, and I mean, I stopped counting the number of times where a scene will play out like, you know, character one enters and says, hey, I need to talk to you about something. And they'll go, not now. I'm leaving to go to the emergency room. And then the person will go, okay, well, we can talk later. And they'll go, oh, you need to talk. Well, come in. I'll make some tea. Like, nothing. They lose, like, object permanence or their short-term memory to where things that happened 30 seconds ago that seemed relevant
are not.
And they're not a part of the scene. I think that's what made it so anxiety-inducing for me, was that things would just get brought up all willy-nilly. Yeah. And then forgotten about just as quickly as they were mentioned and seemed like they were going to be a part of it. Nothing's a part of it. Nothing is real, Greg.
No.
Nothing is real in this movie.
We get the drug dealer storyline that with Denny.
What's his name? Drug dealer Jeff or something? They're not very subtle about what they call him.
My name is Jeff.
Chris R.
They talk Chris about R, that in the disaster dealer. Artist, where the guy was like, shouldn't I just be Chris? No, you're Chris R. It makes no sense. But yeah, the drug dealer, he's played by Zac Efron in the Disaster Artist. Hilarious. But yeah, so it's the
okay kid. Another like unnerving thing about this is that no one in this circle of friends reacts in any way, anything more than like curious.
Yeah.
interested to the accusation or idea that one of their friends has punched his girlfriend or fiance.
Yeah.
Or for the ones that may think that she's making it up, like this collective shrug that she may be ruining this guy's life on purpose. And no one, there is not a single actual human reaction or interaction with anything.
Yes.
Receiving really bad news, acting like you hate somebody, acting like you love somebody. It's astonishing. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And we have three films in this bracket where they were like amateur or amateur adjacent filmmakers, right. Plan 9, Manos,
yeah.
And this one.
Yeah.
But this is by far of the three, the most hinged. I don't think that you could make a movie this wild ass on purpose.
Yeah, I agree.
Are you ready for this?
Well, the thing that's crazy about it is the fact that he funded at least about $6 million. No one knows really where he got his money from. He funded himself. He paid everybody. So it was kind of like they were captives of the money. So he wrote the script. He was able to control the production. So it is his baby, just like Manos and Plan 9 is Ed Wood's baby. This is his baby, and it's a very awkward, just mess of a baby. It shits everywhere, and no one cleans it up, and it just stays on the screen for 2 hours. And the thing of me, I like Manos, and Manos is short, mercifully. If Manos was an hour and 51 minutes, I would have probably been, okay, I can't do this anymore. The fact that it's like 75 minutes, all right, I can laugh my way through that. Plan 9 is delightfully funny, unintentionally and intentionally, and it gets endearing overall. This was excruciating. Like when you texted me and you were saying you were having a really hard time watching this, I can relate because it was one of those that, again, like with Battlefield Earth, had to take breaks. All right, let me pause it for a second, go on my phone, because I need to refresh, I need to rinse that out of my brain, because it's hurting my brain that this actually exists. And there's so many scenes like that. The countless love scenes get to be laughable over time. It gets to be the point like, oh my God, there's another one. It's so unsexy. The fact that the only reason that the drug dealer is there, because they don't really go into too much other than that Denny's in trouble. And it leads to the gun being there that Johnny eventually offs himself with. That's the only purpose of that scene. So it does at least have a purpose, but so many other parts do not. I mean, the like you said, the mom and telling she has breast cancer, and the mom's irrelevant in the film. The mom's completely irrelevant. There's no
every purpose. Interaction that she has with anybody is even more unhinged than all of the other ones. No. She's crazy. Like, I don't know. I'm convinced. I don't, maybe Tommy Wiseau is like some pioneering generative AI per scientist, data scientist.
Yeah.
And this is like our first attempt at making a fully AI driven movie.
Yeah.
With characters who get 98% of the way towards feeling like humans.
Yeah.
But that 2%, Greg, is so important. It's what keeps us out of the, what do they call that? The uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Where like robots that get too lifelike start to become real weird and creepy. Every actual human adult in this movie is bordering on uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Because they look like humans. And for the most part, they speak English like some humans do. But everything is just slightly off, just enough to where you know it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
And I wrote to you. I said, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. And then 6 minutes later, I texted you, this is so stressful. I can't handle this.
Yes, you did. I was like, yeah, you'll get through it. What did I say?
Only barely.
But it's so much that when you watch it, you have to, it is thought provoking in a bad way, because one of the things I thought while watching it was, what did the real life Lisa do to Tommy that made him write a character that is so narcissistic, self-centered, and basically evil of a woman? It is like, it is the symbol of somebody who has been wrong, and this is how they perceive. So if anybody's ever cheated on you or broke your heart,
you've got $6 million.
Well, yeah, your perception of them changes to where they become this evil incarnate, because Lisa has no redeeming qualities about her. Through the whole film, she talks about, I'll do what I want to make myself happy. I don't. She's like, there's no remorse. Like in a regular movie about infidelity, you have the guilt. You have the journey. Yeah. Well, I'm in love with this guy. I don't want to break his heart, but I have to make sure I have my own happiness and blah, blah, blah. Nope, not Lisa. Lisa, from beginning to end, is all in it for Lisa. The whole thing with, so silly, getting him drunk so that she can claim that he hit her, it makes absolutely
no sense. Know I don't drink, Lisa. Yes, I'll have a drink.
The way he drinks.
Again, it's so very, like, nothing anyone says in this movie can be trusted, yeah, because you don't know if in the very next scene they're either going to ignore that was established. Yeah. You know, it's like, it was, I mean, it could have been, and it wouldn't have surprised me. They do these cut scenes that I believe are meant to indicate like a passing of time, but it's just like landmarks around, yeah, San Francisco, or like exterior shots. But like, it wouldn't have surprised me at all to hear them say that they live in like Chicago or something, because there was that little regard for consistency of narrative or consistency of thought or consistency of action,
right,
for the characters. Like, we as people, and I guess it's something that you have to do when you're writing a movie, is you probably do these character studies where you get to the simple stuff. What is this character's name? And even if you're not ever going to say it in the movie, you probably give them a middle name. You give them a hometown. You write down whether their parents, yeah, were together or they're, yeah, divorced. What are their motivations? How much, yeah, schooling have they have? You create all this because even if it's not ever going to be explicitly said in the movie,
right,
you've got to have this Bible for, yeah, the way your character thinks and the way your character acts based on that thinking and the, yep, way that your character speaks based on their acting and thinking. And you do that to avoid what we find in this, which is, I mean, I think that's what makes it feel so unhinged and frantic, frenetic, you know, is that nothing, I mean, I was making a joke earlier when I said nothing is real, but really, yeah, in this movie, nothing is real. You never get a sense of comfort that what I'm seeing of this character is who this character is and who they are going to be the next time that this character shows up in a scene.
Yeah.
Except, yeah, for Lisa, who's horrible.
Yeah.
But even her demeanor, you know, everything's off. And I'm surprised that you could find five actors.
Yeah. They got paid.
That could be all this bad at the same time, mm-hmm, in the same ways. That not one of them had this kind of like standout role where you could go, you know, in a movie, in a toilet bowl floating with turds, I found this one redeeming diamond floating around in there. Yeah. Nothing, Greg, nothing. There, and so my question to you, yeah, is, I'm going to give you, okay, three options.
All right.
This is not a blind ranking. I think that's a popular thing that the kids these days do. Okay. You don't have to rank these blind.
All right.
But which of these is the worst?
Okay.
Is it the acting? Is it the script? Or is it the directing, you know, the way the movie's actually put together and made? What say you?
You know, from my standpoint, I would definitely, the least important thing to me is the directing, because it's irrelevant. The green screens, it would never going to be any better than what it was based on where they filmed it. Acting is atrocious, but with the right script, you can even get through that. We've seen this with independent films with some stiff actors where the writing is what takes it across the finish line. The writing is, to me, aimless. It is clearly somebody who just had a kind of an agenda of a personal story to them, but had no really way of going about telling it. No training on how to write. There's no outline. It's aimless. It wanders through the scenes. It does go in a linear path, but other than it being from point A to point B, it's all over the place. And I think
it's for a movie with so little going on.
Yeah.
That no one could figure out. And I guess when you have authoritative control, yeah, like apparently Tommy had in this, because it was his thing, you know, maybe you're going to run, you know, afoul of this, but yeah, that no one was able to step back and turn this, I mean, not just this movie into something cohesive, any individual scene. Yeah. Greg, I mean,
without a doubt,
I'm never going to watch this again.
No.
My heart can't handle it. No. But if I did, I still don't think that you could find even one scene, 1 minute and a half to 3 to 4 minute scene that started, went to the middle, and went to the end that made any sense.
Well, let's try.
And so not only can... Okay. All right.
Let's watch this one. Which is, again, another iconic scene. Another iconic scene. It's horrible.
I never hit you. You shouldn't have any secrets from me. I'm your future husband.
You sure about that? Maybe I'll change my mind.
Don't talk like that. What do you mean?
What do you think? Women change their minds all the time.
You must be kidding, aren't you?
Look, I don't want to talk about it. I'm going to go upstairs and wash up and go to bed.
How dare you talk to me like that? You should tell me everything.
I can't talk right now.
Why, Lisa? Please talk to me, please. You're part of my life. You are everything. I could not go on without you, Lisa.
You're scaring me.
You are lying. I never hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
Why are you so hysterical?
Do you understand life? Do you?
Do you understand life?
It is... Dude, I mean... I have never seen anything like this.
No, I don't think anyone has.
This man, it is so crazy. Words can't describe it, because it is indescribable what you're seeing. I mean, it couldn't even be recreated. Like, I was having like this existential crisis where I wasn't even sure that I wanted to be alive in the same space-time, yeah, where this movie exists. And then I started thinking, you know, they talk about this idea that there's like infinite parallel universes out there, and so the structure of them is the same, but like,
right,
different things are happening. And I wondered, in an infinite number of universes, would there be one out there where people found this movie to be entertaining or even worthy of existing? And the natural thing to say is that yes, because there's infinite numbers of them, you know, infinity is pretty big. And so you go on forever and finally you'll stumble upon one. But I don't think that's true, Greg. I think in an infinite number of universes, people would watch the room and be just as confused as we were. I don't even think I have asked you, I'm like, have you seen this before we watched this?
No, like I was saying earlier, and I mentioned it, I had watched The Disaster Artist is the closest came. The movie with James Franco and Dave Franco and Seth Rogen and many other people. It's a great film. But I had seen the memes and I'd seen a lot of clips, but I'd never like watched it in its entirety until this week when we were preparing for this. And I was expecting a bad film that I would laugh at, like Plan 9 and Manos. Instead, it was excruciating. And I can see how people would go and, like I said earlier, and with a group, have a few drinks and just make fun of this film and just crap all over it and have a good time. I don't begrudge anybody that does that. I think they still do it. More power to you. For me, it's just so brutal that I would never watch it again either. Even in a group, I wouldn't put anybody through that. It's a mess.
But, okay, yes, that's true. And I guess unless you have like a humiliation fetish like I do, you should like,
I know you have some fetishes. I know you have some.
Yeah. You shouldn't subject yourself to this, but at the same time, I mean, this is the only movie that does this.
Yeah.
Like whatever this is a once in a lifetime thing. You'll never know what it's like to watch The Room for the first time after you've watched it for the first time. And you can't go back to that, because if I pulled it up tonight, you know, we get done with this, I eat a little dinner, lay in bed and go, you know, we just talked about it, it's top of mind, I'm going to watch The Room again. It wouldn't be the same. I mean, it would be as bad, but it wouldn't be the same. But I mean, I don't know. There's really nothing else left to say about it. The acting was bad. Tommy Wiseau makes Ashton Kutcher look like Marlon Brando in this thing. The script was bad. The directing was probably the best part of this movie, which is crazy.
Yeah.
The redeeming thing about this is that Tommy does end up shooting himself. Johnny end up unaliving himself.
Poor Johnny. As he rubs himself with the dress.
See, everything. Like, you can't even just have a character die without doing something fucking weird. Rubbing his crotch with her clothes.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's bizarre.
It's bizarre. So crazy.
I guess we don't really have to vote on this. We don't have to go through all that rigmarole. We kind of knew before we even started that The Room was going to be bad. We texted about it. We normally will reserve our opinions for the show, but in this case, there was no need. The Room is clearly the worst of these two movies, and it will go on into our final four, which will be Mac and Me, Tiptoes, and Battlefield Earth, the worst movies of all that we've seen so far on this podcast. And I tell you what, all four were extremely hard to watch. So I think the debate next week, when we get into it, next Tuesday is when we're going to do the final four for this. I think it's going to be fun. I mean, clearly there's a front runner, but there's a case that could be made for all four of these stinkers. It really could.
Dude, this is crazy. It's crazy that this one ends up on the same side of the bracket as Battlefield Earth, which when I watched, I was certain that I had seen the worst movie ever made.
Yeah.
But like you said, that was eight movies ago. A lot can happen in a month. I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know what we're going to do next week.
Well, we're going to find out.
We'll figure it out.
That is our next show. It's going to be next Tuesday, the 4th of February. We're going to bring you the final four of the bad, best, worst movies of all time, whatever we've decided to call this. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining tonight on the live stream. We saw quite a few people in here. Thank you again for being in here. If you want to catch us, we're here usually on Tuesdays on Twitch or YouTube or Facebook Live. If you want to email us with any idea for a suggestion, you can do so at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. Next Tuesday, in addition to our Final Four, like we always do, we will announce the next category. It's going to be a very special one, and I think you're going to enjoy seeing the reveal of the 8 movies in the next category. Again, Twitch is Box Office Battle Pod. YouTube is at Box Office Battle Podcast. If you want to go in there, like the previous episodes, we appreciate you doing that. Give us some love. And again, be here, back here next Tuesday, 4th of February, for the Final Four of the best, worst movies of all time. So, Eric, we've made it through them all. We don't have to watch them again.
Okay, that is the silver lining to all this.
We just got to decide.
We appreciate you all listening and tuning in. I don't know if people say tuning in anymore, but I'm of an age where we do. We appreciate you all. Until the next time, you guys be excellent to each other, and we'll see you down the road.
We will see you on February 4th. Have a great, great week, everyone. We'll see you soon. And, oh, and go Birds. Super Bowl.